The 920 KVEC Podcast Network is presented by the Slo County Real Estate Podcast with Hal Swayze. Up-to-date information on the local real estate market on your time. New episodes weekly at the podcast link at 920kvec.com and wherever you get your podcasts. California DRE 01111911.
KVC News Talk time is now 6:07 on this Tuesday, November 29th, 2022. Dave Congleton here with you. We have enjoyed the show thus far today, and there's no reason to believe that this next hour, the final hour today, will not be equally strong, because it's a very important subject. Always good to be in conversation with Dr. James Armstead, who takes us around the world and reacts to various news stories. And what is coming out of China? We just heard ABC News. If you have been following it, mass protests have spread across China in the past month, from manufacturing hubs to universities, cities, and minority regions in the far west, with more than a dozen locations verified. In extraordinary scenes, citizens have gathered despite the significant risk of arrest. They have called for their country to be freed, not just from the government's pandemic policies, but also from its far-reaching control over their lives. With that in mind, we welcome Professor Armstead back to the broadcast. Jim, good evening, sir.
Good evening, Dr. Congleton. How are you?
We're good, sir. Thanks for making the time to join us. I have to start off by saying when I'm reading these stories and hearing these reports, I'm going back to 1989 in Tiananmen Square.
Well, this is exciting, just as that was. And it's new. It's something unexpected. This is a police state. There is enormous control. So the fact that there are people, thousands of people, from all over the country, all walks of life, out protesting, and not only saying the oppressive COVID restrictions that in many cases are not working and that people are worried about, they don't believe in, when we were able to get a few to talk to us. They're also saying, as you pointed out, they want changes in the government, and it goes even further than that. I've been watching the last two or three days, the CNN, the ABC reporters who live there, who get out, who are amongst the protesters, and protesters are talking to them at some risk to themselves. They are saying they want President Xi Jinping to leave. They want him to step down. They're actually saying that, chanting that in the protest. This is quite extraordinary in this country.
Well, I start off by saying this reminds me of Tiananmen Square, and then sadly, the other thing this reminds me of is Hong Kong, where you had a sudden burst of protest that went on for a long time, and we both know how that ended.
Yes, that wasn't good. That wasn't good. But remember, political things are like climbing a hill with a heavy backpack, pushing a rock up a hill. You push, you push, you push. There are a lot of factors. You're tired. There's the weather. There's the ground. And suddenly, maybe you give way. Maybe that you get to the top. You drop the rock in a hole. So we had the fall of the Soviet Union, which I, for one, predicted on radio, on live radio and television, I predicted the Soviet Union was not going to fall that quickly. It would be years further. They would go on. I'm proud to say that. You know, my predictions were wrong in that particular case, that enough factors were present that it broke the camel's back, that we had a sudden change because all of those things were there, all of the pressures were there, and finally, there was something that perhaps you couldn't predict. Like, for example, a Gorbachev saying the continuation of the Soviet Union economically wasn't going to work, and that he was going to allow Russia to go free. The other Soviet Socialist Republics declared their own independence, moved away. Even he didn't know what was going to happen and how quickly. What's going to happen here? We've got this, and it started Xinjiang, which is in the very far west, as you mentioned, is a Uyghur area. And, of course, there have been problems with Uyghurs for a very long time, 50 years, 60 years. There have been problems, human rights violations, people who disappear, hundreds, thousands who disappear. They go off to, some of them, off to re-education camps, they're called, where they can be presented with the right way of living, understand that it's a communist country, and many of them would say that understanding that that they are not members of the Han society, the predominant ethnic group in China. They are outside of that. They come from Islamic origins. They come from somewhat further to the west, and they're integrated in the society in ways, or not integrated in society in ways that we would object to here, that we would say that's a violation of human rights. They are not given their own dignity, their own language is suppressed, their culture is suppressed, and the Chinese aren't dealing with that very well. And of course, as you well know, they do not like outside criticism.
Right.
The Chinese actually think that public criticism from outside, it's not only not polite, not good manners, but it's something that shouldn't exist in international law, that they view sovereignty as the absolute right to do what you want to do inside your own country, and no one else even has a right to criticize.
So given
a very extreme view of sovereignty.
All right. So given all that, what do you imagine the Biden administration is doing now, and what should they be doing as these events unfold in China?
Well, Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, has been saying from the White House that we support, and the president reiterates this, we support the Chinese right to protest their own government, to protest what they see as oppression, as just disagreement, that this is a right, a human right, that every political group has in any country in the world. So we've been standing behind that principle. That's a public enunciation at the National Security Council level. The president has talked about that intermittently, not just now, but obviously has talked about that at earlier times. And we are seeing now the rest of the world slowly warming up, not quite as fast as I would like to see public pronouncements from the EU, from our allies, and from the rest of the world, exactly what's going on. We're in harried times right now. There's a war going on in Ukraine. We've got the production is being reduced in the developed world. We've got the supply chain crisis going on that affects the entire world. We've got the food problems in the third world because of about 20%, over 20% of the grain that comes from Russia and Ukraine is not being shipped on a steady basis. It's started up again intermittently, but not on a steady basis that people can depend on. We're having disagreements, of course, in the UN, the General Assembly. There are a number of people who are protesting Russia and challenging Russia, and we have the sanctions. It's a very tense world. It's not the regular day when you look out of your window and you see things peaceful and quiet along the Pacific Ocean where you live, and it's just a wonderful place to be. It's not the same world as it was a year ago.
Yeah.
When you look out in the mornings, they look the same, but it's not.
All right, but beyond Jake Sullivan saying we support the right of people to protest in China, is there anything else the Biden administration can do? Can they get further involved in this?
Well, we can certainly make presentations before the UN, depending upon how, and I'm worried about this. I think if this goes on a bit longer, we are going to see, because we've got press that are integrated throughout China. They're certainly in the big cities and in the places where, as you say, the universities are and the large production centers are. We've got members of the press there, so we're going to see it. I think it's very likely that President Xi cracks down, that there starts to be more violence. Now, hundreds of people have been taken away, but it hasn't been extremely violent, at least what I've seen so far. The protesters are talked to, they're threatened, then some are arrested, probably to have a demonstration, look, if the rest of you don't go away, then we're coming back. In Beijing last night, there were large numbers of protesters out on one of the major streets. The reporter who covered that and talked about it went back and interviewed some of the people there, went back to the same site. The streets eerily quiet, and several blocks we could see where the camera showed there were police cars and vans, what we would used to call in Chicago paddy wagons.
Yep.
They were there with their lights on, parked on the sides, both sides of the street, lights going, making it pretty clear that if you show up again, you're liable to be hauled away.
All right. If I don't take this break, I'm going to be hauled away. Dr. James Armstead back on Hometown Radio, giving us his perspective about the growing unrest in China and what it all means. We'll pick up the conversation in 2 minutes. You're listening to The Dave Congleton Show.
Now back to Dave.
You have landed on The Dave Congleton Show, always your hometown radio talk show. Dr. James Armstead joins us. We're talking about the unfolding unrest in China. A little bit later on, we'll shift over and get an update on Ukraine. We'll welcome your phone calls as well for the professor. A couple other things, Jim, I'd like to ask you about China. One, what are you thinking if you're in Taiwan right now and you're watching all this? And how does this possibly alter the concern over a Chinese invasion of Taiwan?
Well, the Chinese right now, the Chinese in Taiwan, have to be thinking that, wow, the world for them has really changed. 2 months ago, we had 70 incursions in Indian airspace of Chinese fighter bomber planes. We had daily incursions, 20 to 30 a day, for over a month around Taiwanese airspace where it was illegally overflown. That stopped. Then, of course, after that busy month, August and September, we had the re-election of President Xi. He now comes to his third 6-year term, a man who's just about 70. That essentially means life. I mean, it looks like he's president as long as he wants to stay in. We physically saw the removal of the previous president of China and a very high party official coming up from many, many years, gets to the very top. He's physically removed by two of Xi's men from the party congress publicly. This is at the meeting. There are thousands of delegates there watching this physically. This is a clear sign that I'm now in charge. I am totally in charge. There are no other centers of power. This is going to be the new China. I am the new leader. One of the important tenets of that leadership was the reorganization of the old Chinese territories that are gone. Nepal was taken back years ago. We've got Hong Kong reintegrated, and the old one China but two systems was essentially being thrown out.
Yeah.
There's going to be one China, one system, it's mine, that you people in Hong Kong are going to do it my way. That was a lesson to the Taiwanese. You know, are you going to make a deal? The Kuomintang, the old party that fought the communists in the Civil War, that party is the one that was softening, that was talking about maybe some sort of deal should be made. We ought to get together with these folks. There's some way to work things out with the mainland. Well, the example of Hong Kong in the last year, year and a half, 2 years, has made it crystal clear. When you start arresting the city council members, when you start arresting academics and students at the university with relatively, at least in the beginning, mild protest, and then, of course, the violence starts, the police get really tough on the students and the demonstrators. When you see that in Hong Kong, what does that tell the Taiwanese? What does that let them know about where they're going and their worries?
Yeah.
Their threats that they were going to be invaded, they were dealing with with all those sorts of things. Well, now the supreme authority in China is being personally requested to step down by thousands of people in the street. That's got to make them feel some comfort. And unfortunately, I think it may be a false comfort in the sense that we don't know what he's going to do about this just yet. Mm-hmm. And it's very quiet at the top in China. There's not much being said.
I'm also struck by the fact that all this is going down. What's been 2 weeks since he met with Biden?
About 3 weeks, that's right.
3 weeks?
2.5 weeks. He met with Biden, and apparently the deal was made that the relationship between NATO and Russia was important to the Chinese. And the Chinese wanted bilateral relations between NATO member states supporting the Ukrainians rather than NATO. So it wasn't an alliance with a fixed internet multinational point of view doing things, but the individual countries bilaterally supplying arms, supplying financial aid, supplying other sorts of aid and comfort to the Ukrainian forces and civilian population, and that they could go along with that. That didn't seem to bother them, and hence any interference with what China was doing with the Russians would not be looked at quite so stringently when it came to sanctions and other sorts of things. So this was sort of a deal not to violate the previous deals, you might say, that go along, get along, that if you're not pushing this as a NATO focus, as a NATO change of policy, and it's the individual nations bilaterally, then China is not going to vociferously attack this in the UN. China is not going to really work against that and, you know, sort of have a sanctions fight, you might say, between the groups of nations. And now, what's happened to that deal? You know, what does this all mean for President Xi? You know, what does he do? Is he now feel threatened and he strikes back violently? Does he negotiate? Does he talk? Does he come from this position of supreme power where he physically has two of the, I was going to say heavies, they weren't thugs, they were men in suits who were part of the program. I'm sure they were security men, but they come over, they remove the former president, who's an elderly man. And now they claim that he was feeling poorly and they were helping him out. He looked very confused and he didn't look as though he was asking to be helped to an aid station. Hmm. He really looked like he was being taken out against his will. He stops, puts his hand on Xi's shoulder, you know, looking for some help. Like, you know, hey, these guys are taking me out. What's going on? You know, can you help me out here? You know, I brought you up. I was your mentor. And Xi nods his head for them to run and remove him. He stops and the shoulder, the hand on the shoulder to several other of the luminaries present. And same thing. They look over at the boss, and the boss, you know, says, this guy goes.
Yeah.
And he's removed.
It sounds like a bad movie. But I got about 90 seconds before the news break. In modern Chinese history, the president has never capitulated to the people.
No, this is, nor have the people come out since Tiananmen Square, given what happened there, nor have they come out with this kind of sensitivity to what the problems are. That maybe general protest about something local, you know, the traffic or the lack of housing, which is true in some cases. I've been to Shanghai and seen some of that, those housing problems and those issues. When they have a construction zone that's thrown up because they're rebuilding something, they just shut everything down. You figure out how to get to work, how to do whatever you're going to do. Well, this is directed toward COVID, directed toward the president. Wow. Major policy. We want to change national government. This is something new. And different.
Yeah, if we had been talking a month ago, and we were talking a month ago, neither one of us would have predicted this. It is
absolutely not.
What's the old saying? May you live in extraordinary times?
Yes, may you live in interesting times, and boy, do we.
All right. Always good to be in conversation with Professor Armstead. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to go check in with California Headline News, followed by an ABC News radio update. Craig is standing by the very latest in time saver traffic and weather together. We have been told to expect rain towards the end of the week. Let's hope that happens. We will continue our conversation with Dr. Armstead and shift over to Ukraine. with the approaching winter. What does that mean for strategy on both sides? We'll welcome your phone calls on either topic. Also happy to read your text messages as well. All that straight ahead in the final half hour of today's edition of Hometown Radio. Happy Tuesday. Do me a favor, start your Wednesday morning off with First Look. Andy Morrison, Scott Taylor have you covered with everything you need to know to get you out the door from 6 to 9, followed by Markley, Van Camp, and Robbins from 9 until noon, followed by Dave Ramsey and the gang from noon until 3. Craig and I are back at 3:05, hello, with the Wednesday edition of Hometown Radio. We are visiting, as we are known to do from time to time, with Dr. James Armstead. We have started off talking about China and the situation over there. And Jim, as we're back with you, interesting text message on the Stolberg line. Listener writes, we may be overreacting to the situation in China. What do you think the Chinese thought when the U.S. Capitol building was being overrun by rioters?
Well, I'm sure they enjoyed that. It demonstrated to them that capitalism had failed, that we were not together as a people and focused on what we hold most dear, which is the under the Constitution, the peaceful transfer of power. So the entire basis of the American system was being threatened. Now, the threat was small, a few hundred people. We are not talking about a civil war or anything near that. But it was certainly indicative that all was not well in paradise. Mm-hmm. And our enemies would relish that.
And also, I'd point out that in the January 6th, it was one specific location. What's happening in China seems to be happening across wide regions.
It's all over, yes.
Hundreds of thousands of people. So anyway.
And it's not a few people saying that the legal exercise of government is something we are protesting, and they're radical. China, we're talking people from all ages, all sectors of the community, and not just Uyghurs, where it started, but this has spread to the around the population, it appears, that there's a basic unhappiness with COVID. And you can imagine 3 years of a lockdown, that would not make anybody very happy. But there doesn't seem to be an alternative plan. What else are we doing about it? And of course, focusing this on the president of the country, and this has really been personal. You know, in some ways, the current president and the previous president could both say, I'm doing what the scientists say. This is what Dr. Fauci and his people at the Center for Communicable Diseases are saying to do, and we're doing it. We're developing the vaccines, and you have to take them and wear a mask and whatever. This is a policy that's been personally tested to by President Xi. He's the one who says, this is what we're going to do to stop this. And people aren't happy.
Feel free to join us, 805-543-8830 or 800-549-5832 for Professor Armstead. We're glad to read your texts as well. Another text on the Stolberg line. Listener wants to know if we have any credible estimates as to the number of people who are actually protesting across China.
Well, we know it's thousands because we've got members of the press that are in the various cities that are seeing this, but I don't think anybody's had the chance yet to put some major numbers together.
You can
see. Remember, these cities are huge, 20 million. These are large cities. So in 8 of the largest cities, there are large protests with thousands of people.
And you can see photos and video at different sites online. You can see it for yourself.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah, that's available.
So I also want to make sure we have time to get an update from you about Ukraine. Here it is almost December 1st. That means winter is coming to Ukraine. Let's start with the Ukrainians. What does that mean for them, Jim?
Well, if you think about war plans fighting a war, when the operations people at whatever level you're talking, from you know, battalion level to field army level, when you talk about making a plan, the operations people sit down with the intel people, and there are three things they want to start the discussion with. That's enemy, weather, and terrain. It's always those same three things in that order. So what are your enemy capabilities? What can they do? What threat do they pose to you? What's the weather like? What are you going to have to deal with? What are you going to have to overcome? Is it bright and sunny? The ground is dry and hard? Are you going to hit a soft sandy beach? Are you going to climb a mountain road? You need to know those things. And of course, the terrain factors into that very well. Are you using vehicles? Are people walking? You've got infantry. Are we trying to fly in stormy weather? Whatever that's going to be. Well, when you think about what winter does to combat in this part of the world that we're dealing with, all three of those things are affected. All three are affected. Of course, the weather itself, dealing with that, your personnel, you've got to dress them for it. You've got to feed them more. It takes approximately twice as many calories for a soldier to function at zero as it does at 75 degrees, approximately twice as many. So that's how much food do I have to get to people? So I need to get hot soup out to them a couple of times a day, keep coffee going and get that up to the front lines where they are. Do I have to keep rotating people, get them away from the front line so we can make sure they've got dry socks on, they're not getting frostbitten feet? Equipment doesn't work as well. You know, we have to change the oil that to a lighter weight oil in vehicles, on rifles, just something as simple as cleaning your rifle, oiling it. That gets a different weight of oil when it gets to be 40 below. When somebody tells you that it's 40 below, you have to think of 40 below Fahrenheit and 40 below centigrade are the same. It's the same. You don't have to worry about the differences. When they say it's 40 below, it's really cold. And your listeners that come from back east, like you from Chicago, certainly know what that, you know, we've seen 15, 20 below, and you know how cold that is.
Right.
Imagine at 40 below.
So the big question then becomes, who does winter favor, the Russians or the Ukrainians?
Winter always favors the defender. And right now, given the process of the war, the prosecution of the campaigns, the Russians are actually the defenders. The Russians they've retreated. They have shortened their lines of communication, and they've done that because winter was coming. That was on purpose. So they don't have as far to reach out as they did 5 months ago to get to their front lines, to get them beans, bullets, and oil and fuel and all of those other things that you need to keep a war going. The aggressor, the attacker, has got to get out from his nice warm trench, his nice warm vehicle. He's got to get out on foot and attack the enemy. He's got to close with and destroy the enemy. You have to get out in the cold to do that. You have to run your vehicles to be able to do that. So all of the equipment you've got, it's got to work in really bad conditions, and you're moving. You're getting it dirty. You're using it up. The defender, he's in his trench. He's built in as much rotation of warm places during the day as you can possibly get. You know, if you got people out for 6 hours, 8 hours, and you get them in someplace where it's warm, you can have them function a lot better.
All right.
So the defender is actually by these conditions.
All right, we got Lance in San Luis on KVEC. Yes, hi, sir. Lance.
Oh, hey, Dr. Jim and Dave. Hey, kind of shifting back to China.
Sure.
The Pentagon came out today with the report, kind of the strength of China's military, specifically their nuclear capability. My question is, how did our government get their nuclear capabilities so wrong? They were predicting, they had 200 warheads a couple of years ago, and we were predicting it'll take them a decade to double that. Well, they doubled that in two years, and they are now saying that they'll be able to have up to 1,500 nuclear warheads by 2035, but at the rate they're going, they'll probably be there in the next 3-4 years. How did we get it so wrong?
Is he right on that, Jim?
Well, those figures aren't terribly off. They're in the ballpark. But let's talk about intelligence and what it means when you get an intelligence estimate. Intelligence comes from all kinds of things. You get some intelligence in the clear. People flying over the country and observing. what your own forces observe when you're on the rim of closed countries. We have attachés in country who get to look at things like military parades, who get to watch exercises to see what the enemy's doing. We can certainly look at the money that's spent where it's not a secret, in particular areas of production, some of which is in the clear. You need lots of things like metals, for example, which that isn't going to be much of a secret, whereas processing uranium is going to be. You're not going to find out easily how much of that is done. So an intelligent estimate is just that. It's an estimate based on all kinds of factors, learning things that are secret where you can, learning things that are in the clear. You have your own intelligence assets that are available to ferret out some information that is not in the clear in public, and you put all of that together, you make an estimate. Sometimes the estimates are spot on, and they are very good. Our estimate of Russian forces and how capable they were during the Cold War were actually much higher than the reality was. That we gave the Russians credit for being more capable, weapons better, them operating better. And now when you put it to the test, for example, look at what we've seen in the Ukraine.
Lance,
instead of losing in 3 weeks, they're winning after 9-10 months.
Lance?
Yeah, well, see, I'd rather overestimate. I mean, because all of a sudden, 2 years ago, we're saying we're doing all our strategic planning based on a certain assumption that it's X, and it turns out that it's actually Y, and it was the wrong way. You know, I'm happy to hear that we overestimated Russia's capability, because that meant we were always going to be ahead of them. Where this looks like, even though I know we have roughly 4,000 nuclear warheads, the second question would be, why do we think they're actually ramping up their nuclear capability? And, you know, I'm concerned that we got it so wrong and we were basing our future strategies on such a low estimate.
And how much of that is theater and how much of that is real, Jim, would be my part of it.
Well, that's a very good point. I was going to make that point in terms of the estimate itself. How, you know, when you give an estimate, you get an estimate in a briefing. One of the things that the intelligence person there tells you is how they feel about that estimate. We think we've got 90% of the information that we need to stand behind this. We've got 50% of the information. You know, we could be off by a factor of one, a factor of two, whatever that happens to be. So that's part of a good, and that, where the intelligence officer, where the rubber meets the road, is tell me what you know, tell me what you estimate, and tell me what you're guessing about going to do with the things you've got.
All right.
Now, as you go progressively down the line of what you're sure about as you do that estimate. You know, there are things you know that are hard things. You know, the number of troops they got.
Yeah.
You know, there are things you're not sure about. The number of weapons of a certain type, where they keep it a secret, you're less sure. What they intend to do about, you know, that gets a little fuzzy.
All right.
And that's what you pay the intel guy for. Tell me what all that means.
Lance, does that answer your question?
That does, and I always appreciate when Dr. Armstead's on, because he has that insight that we don't get from any other news source.
That's why I keep bringing him back. Lance, very kind of you to call in. Thank you. 805-543-8830. Dr. James Armstead is back on this broadcast talking about the unrest in China and winter coming to Ukraine. On the Stolberg line, you kind of address this, but follow up for Susan wants to know if what's happening in China, does it have any consequences on Putin, Ukraine, and protests in Russia?
Oh, absolutely. I think Lance's question went directly to this. When you look at an estimate of China, and China has got more of a specific kind of weapon, giving them more capability in a certain area than we thought, that goes directly to the change of political fortunes in Asia. When we started this war with Ukraine on the 24th of February this year, when we started, Russia was the senior military power in Asia. And we've got some big countries there. The largest country in the world, Russia, 11 time zones. The two most populous countries in the world, India and China, which are at loggerheads. So this is a dynamic political environment. Well, now with Russia expanding spending a vast amount of its capability in using troops, high levels of casualties, using up a lot of its the impedimenti of war, the railroads, the trucks, all of those things that support internally and the production, and China not doing any of that, the relative position of China goes up. When this war with Ukraine is over, China will be the senior military power in Asia, no matter what the settlement is. If, you know, there's a peace treaty tomorrow, and the Ukrainians, I don't think they're going to do this, but if they agreed that we'll stop where we are now, status quo ante bellum, we'll stop right now, we keep what we've got, and we'll stop shooting there. At that point, China is still senior in terms of its political and military power because it hasn't expended anything. It's gotten to that position because it can buy oil from Russia. It has money. It's the second largest economy in the world. It is growing faster than Russia and continues to be able to buy and build what it needs for its military capability. And, of course, as the Belt and Road Initiative and the other parts of its economy continue to expand, it becomes politically more powerful from the economic side.
All right.
So that's a sea change we're seeing in Asia right now.
We are in conversation with Professor James Armstead, talking about China, talking about Ukraine, talking about Russia. There's a lot of talk going on here. We'll come back for a final segment on AM 920, FM 96.5, News Talk, KVEC. You really need a college degree to succeed in this world. We're going to talk about that tomorrow. Interesting article says that employers across the country are beginning to rethink what they're looking for in hiring new employees. Elizabeth Barrett, the reluctant therapist on Friday, talks about growing research that shows that more and more Americans are choosing to be alone. We're with you weekday afternoons from 3:05 to 7 o'clock on KVEC. We've always enjoy our conversations with Dr. Armstead. He has been commenting on the growing unrest in China and also talking about the approaching winter in Ukraine, what that means. If you want in on the conversation, we need to hear from you now, please. 805-543-8830. Jim on the Stolberg line. Listener wants to know if we have any U.S. military advisors in Ukraine.
Well, I'm sure we do. I'm sure, of course we do. You know, but that's not public information.
Would they be military?
You know, how could we function without them?
Yeah,
you could have special forces people. You have intelligence people who are doing things, but they're not part of an open operation. You know, they're not going to be wearing American uniforms and that sort of thing. We'd be crazy not to.
Yeah, but we'd be denying it, wouldn't we?
Yes. Yeah, that it would be enormously foolish not to have people there. And there are civilians there. You know, people who build anti-tank weapons, yeah. You know, people who build anti-aircraft weapons, they're seeing how their weapons are working.
Let's take another
call.
They're
making design changes.
Let's take another call.
We're training Ukrainians out of function.
Let's take another call. We've got Gary in Pismo on KVEC. Hi, Gary.
Hey, hi, Dave. Hi, Doctor.
Hi.
I think I asked this question 6 months ago, but and the answer then was that we couldn't do it because the Ukrainians could not use the weapons they were getting from NATO to do it. What I'd like to see, if it's possible for the Ukrainians to use their own rockets or Russian-made rockets and artillery to fire into Russia and impose misery on Russian towns and Russian people so they get an understanding of what they've been doing to the Ukrainians for the last 5 months. Is that possible?
I'm at the three-minute mark.
I'd like to see that myself. The you know, HIMARS comes with more than one kind of munition, and there is a HIMARS munition that it has a little over 100 miles, about 130 miles. Well, as we move closer and closer to the Russian border, being able to hit the railroad junctions where heavy equipment is offloaded, put onto trucks, where supplies and support depots are located, being able to hit those could be very important for the tactical operations going on at the FEBA, the forward edge of the battle area.
Hang on. Craig has a public service announcement.
Gary, could you please stop breathing on the phone?
Sorry, my phone's really a crappy little flip phone, so I'm sorry about that.
I'm sorry, Dr. Armstead.
That's all right. Gary, your question is great. Don't worry about the breathing. I agree with the premise of the question. I think that's a good idea. We are considering being able to give the Ukrainians longer-range munitions. Now, obviously, the danger is how longer range and how much use by the Ukrainians before we escalate the conflict. For those who say, oh, you just can't go over the border at all, you can't do that, well, I would argue, in fact, I believe the comment last week was the Russians are going to take the gloves off. I think when you send 209,000 people across the border into somebody else's country, you've taken the gloves off.
What else, Gary?
Well, and I think the answer back in July was that we could not fire any of our NATO weapons into Russia at all without escalating it to a NATO incident. So, again, do Ukrainians on their own have any Russian or any equipment from anywhere else in the world that they can fire over the border and really pound Russia?
Certainly they do. Remember, they used to say about the Soviet Union, the Soviet Union had the people and the Ukrainians had the brains for the rest of the Soviet Union. They were the people who made the missiles. They were the people who made the computers. They were the people who developed the long-range systems. So that capability is there. I mean, you see how fast they picked up with the new things they've been given.
All right.
They used the old equipment first. They used the old Soviet-era equipment. Then they used the new... You know, the largest supplier of combat equipment on the battlefield for the Ukraine is Russia. The equipment they're leaving when they evacuate quickly.
I understand the equipment is so bad for the Russians, they're using crappy old flip phones.
What a weapon!
We got to go. Garth, or Gary, I keep calling him Garth. Thank you. Another nice job by James Armstead, who gets exactly 40 seconds for a final thought.
Well, I think what we've seen in this entire war is a failure of deterrence. We did not respond well to Georgia, to Crimea, to Syria, or to Donbass in 2014. And now we're reaping the rewards of that. As Ronald Reagan would say, a successful and permanent peace rests on strength and being prepared.
I gave you 40 seconds. Oh, well. Professor, always a pleasure. We appreciate your time, and we will talk again.
Yes, sir.
All right, sir, thank you. That's going to do it for us today. Great show. Thanks to all of our guests. Thanks to our sponsors. Thanks to Craig Hill for his help. And thank you for listening. We'll do it again tomorrow at 3:05. I'm Dave Congleton. Now, Oliver, get out of my chair. I'm coming home. Good night.
The 920 KVEC Podcast Network is presented by the Slo County Real Estate Podcast with Hal Swayze. Up-to-date information on the local real estate market on your time. New episodes weekly at the podcast link at 920kvec.com and wherever you get your podcasts. California DRE 0111911.